because there are some carbon-intensive sources of energy and some non-carbon-intensive sources of energy. And in a sense, there's a fully observable market price. It's just the difference per unit of energy between those two. So in that sense, it seems to me that I understand the utility, the social innovation of having carbon trading, but you know, the price itself is there and observable. We heard earlier from another speaker or questioner about different prices of carbon in markets like the UK, which is higher. Now, to bring this down to a practical question, I have in mind things like the opportunities for gains, not losses, from the introduction of this new system. If you have an asset, and let's take a particular example, I don't wish to suggest that this is a right one to pursue, but take geothermal energy, for example. If you're able privately to create certificates, then you have a bankable asset. And the finance industry, if they recognise the value of that asset, can thereby promote investment in things like transmission lines to bring the energy to where it's needed. Now, it seems to me that with those options before us, there is a hazard in having too low a price, because you thereby undermine the advantage of having gains in the system through bringing new factors of production into use. Would any of the panel care to comment on that?
There's a few things in this kind of discussion. I mean, Belinda used the cute little trick before. It's a good one, so put your hands up. I'll give a person a bottle of rum if they can tell me what's been missing in this discussion so far. One is a really big missing link in this discussion so far. A bottle of Bundaberg rum, if you can tell me. You can't, righto. It's technology. I mean, we are still getting lost in the logic of our own arguments. We just talked about, and I absolutely agree with everything Belinda said, but the Middle East is building coal-fired power stations. China is putting a gigawatt of coal-fired power station in every 9 days. Yeah, we can sit here and have an academic discussion about carbon prices, but if the carbon price gets ahead of the industry or the capacity for industrial activity to change behaviour on account of technologies, then all you've got is a tax. You've just got a punitive tax, okay? Not something that is actually a market driver. So the point about carbon prices is that you actually want to have a carbon price in place that is going to foster a change in industrial behaviour, hence the linkage with the rate of your technological development. Now, the technologies we're talking about, particularly clean coal technologies, and don't kid yourself, we will not have a global solution to climate change management without a clean coal solution. Everybody will tell you, the International Energy Agency, that we are going to double the production and consumption of coal by 2030. Fossil fuels will be the primary source of energy long after my grandkids are gone. And it's not about a substitution racket for energy sources. You're going to need every single bit of energy source we've got across the globe if we're going to fuel the kind of industrialization that is going on in the developing economies. Half the world is going through an industrialization process, the like of which was seen in the 1890s in America and in the post-war period in Japan. They are going to be searching for energy big time. So we are sitting here talking about what we can do in Australia as part of the leadership equation. Great exercise. But let's get ahead of our own standing in the equation. And the notion about, you know, let's go out and tell countries about how to do global policy. Well, you know, I've been involved in every single negotiation on the world's free trade agreements and trade liberalisation since the WTO was established. You've got to be a bit careful about celebrating your own importance in the scheme of things. So the point is, let's be a leader, but let's not pay such a price that we actually add to our woes. As Belinda said, the point being, we're actually, and this is, goes to the article that was in The Australian yesterday with Jeff Carmody saying, well, maybe we ought to shift to a consumption tax, or putting a price on the consumption of emissions, i.e., on the goods where the emissions are embedded in the product, rather than doing it on the production. Because we're taxing export industries, and we're taxing import competing industries, and we're giving everybody a free ride. That raises all sorts of international trade obligation questions. But back to the fundamental question, and that is, yes, we can have an intellectual discussion about what the carbon price may or might not be, but if you do that in isolation of your linkages with what's going on in the rest of the world, and what's happening in terms of technology development, then you've just got one pillar of the three pillars that you need to be working in sync.
Okay, so let's work out what Mitch just said then. Mitch just said what we want to have is a reintroduction of tariffs in Australia. No, that's what you just said. You want to shift it to a consumption basis. So you want to put in place border tax adjustments. So the consequence of that, and let's be very frank about this. When the task group on emissions trading put its head together last year, the last thing we wanted to do was to create an incentive for a bunch of Australian business people to keep wandering up to Canberra with their hands out. We've been through that. Anybody who remembers anything about Australia's trade history will know that for most of the post-war period, we had a situation where it was better for businesses to come to Canberra and lobby to increase protection than it was to get on and run their businesses in a world-class, efficient manner. Now, that's not a criticism of business, that was a criticism of the framework that government had put in place. What Mitch has just proposed, though, is that by shifting to taxation of consumption, by putting in place border tax adjustments, is to provide a massive incentive for anybody who feels a bit aggrieved, they can't compete, to wander to government and say, look, just push up tariffs for us. Been there, done that, I sure as hell don't want to go back again. So, yes, it's true that in the absence of a global agreement, and that's what we're dealing with here, the absence of a fully-fledged global agreement, there are going to be challenges like this. Now, our judgment in the Department of Climate Change, the judgment of the Task Group on Emissions Trading, the government, the judgment of the Howard government and the judgment of this government is that it's actually less dangerous for us to be trying to deal with this by putting in place support for the most emissions-intensive trade-exposed firms. The issue, though, is that it's transitional support. You need to do it in a way that's transparent, that's explicit, that everybody can see and can be unwound. It took us 30-odd years to unwind tariff protection, and in some areas, as you know from reading the papers the last few weeks, some areas we haven't managed to unwind it yet. Is that really where we want to go? I think not.
I think we should ask Mitch what Mitch said. Mitch did not actually propose that at all. What Mitch did say right from the outset was that I actually don't want to go through a GST food fight. I actually don't want to have this kind of diabolical situation of what you call it, a siren call, the special pleading. And that's because, you know, and I was actually quoting Jeff Carmody's work, but Jeff Carmody said, do you want to have a complex situation with a prospect that it won't work? Or do you want to actually work through something that's a complex situation that might work? Now, the bottom line to what we're talking about here is not going out to special pleading, but actually ensuring that we don't tax our industries into the ground on some fanciful notion that we can lead the world into a platform of global climate change management solutions. That's what Mitch is saying. And Mitch is saying that's not an excuse for not doing something. That's just saying it's got to be measured, it's got to be transitional, and it's got to take a realistic account of not only what we can do in a global leadership sense, but also the pace of technological development. Because if we don't get the kind of breakthrough technologies we're all talking about across every available source of energy, then we're just not going to cut the mustard.
Frank, I think you have a comment, don't you? As long as it's not what Mitch said that Martin said
definitely not what Mitch said. Look, I think the key thing with the Green Paper and the Emissions Trading Scheme is we have to be playing to win, and the context is trying to beat the challenge of climate change. It's inextricably linked with the negotiations which will go on in Poznan and in Copenhagen. But we have to be playing to win, and in that situation, changes are going to come about. The winning situation, change is going to come about. There are about six solutions which we have to drive for: energy efficiency, stopping deforestation, renewable energy and zero emission technologies, the infrastructure that goes with them, accelerating gas, and CCS. All of them. All of those have to be driven. A carbon price on the day will tell us about the acquittal efficiency. The forward price of carbon is much more interesting to me and to anyone who's interested in investing. That will tell us what to invest in, and that will take in information from around the world as well as from around Australia. The final thing I would say is, having worked so closely with many of the emissions intensive trade exposed sector industries over quite a few years, most but not all, lobbied long and hard not to have change. The fact that the lobbying has not worked is frustrating for them, but the burden must not be transferred to the rest of the economy. And so for WWF, for example, we suggest strongly that all permits are auctioned, and then transparently cash assistance goes to those who deserve assistance.
Well, I wonder if we could take questions from the floor. I think there's... Oh, there's someone over there first, sorry. We'll take that question first.
Ben Carney from St. Clair Nightmares. I'm always interested in how people can come up with very different conclusions to the same question, and I think unpacking some of the assumptions behind it is often useful. And to me it seems that one of the big differences here is whether or not you think that the issue of climate change is sufficiently certain and a big enough problem that we have to take action and cap emissions no matter what, or whether it's probably pretty nasty, but you know, if there's economic upside, we don't want to limit that. And I'd be interested on some views. And secondly, if a useful way to get away from all this these issues about who has a cap and who doesn't and where it should be is to move as quickly as possible to a global carbon price with a global cap, and that will get rid of all these issues about who's trade exposed and how much growth the developing countries can have versus us, without having to reference everything to this mythical 1990 world.
And I guess whether the scientists are right, does it really matter? Because the Stone Age didn't end because of a lack of stone. What climate change has really been the Trojan horse for is more energy efficiency. The more energy efficient we are per unit of GDP, the longer the oil age will last to give us a transition to whatever the next economy may be. And so it's really about energy efficiency, which makes sense whether this climate change debate came in or not. I think that's what this scheme is all about, is we're going to have a trading scheme. Let's get over debating whether we're going to have it or not. We're going to have it. So let's make it work and work efficiently. Let's make it work in a way that gets Australia a seat of the table internationally to debate internationally the right thing to do, which is to increase the cost of carbon to make us more energy efficient. But let's bring in the scheme in Australia in a way that's gentle enough so we can iron out the wrinkles and not disadvantage our economy. But net-net, the effect is the oil age will last longer by us getting more energy efficient, whether it's a climate change debate or not. That gives us an extra 20, 30, 40, 50 years beyond what was expected to transition to whether it be coal fusion or who knows what people can be working on next. But really, it's a sensible thing to do for the world, just to be more energy efficient.
I just thought I'd add something to that. In 1980, in my environmental studies degree, I did my special project on a thing called the greenhouse effect. And for an impressionable young undergraduate, this great big challenge that we had ahead of us was very, very scary. And I can't help but think back and think, if only the policymakers had listened to those rather dishevelled university students back in 1980, and I believe even before then, and we'd taken some steps then. So I think we've actually known of the challenges for a very, very long time, and it's extremely gratifying that finally we're actually on a path to doing something about it. And in a sense, the scientists, as we said, it doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it matters in terms of us being able to tweak the responses that we have to dealing with that challenge, but the argument over the science is gone. I think what's challenging us now, though, is the connection being made between what the science is telling us on balance and how we respond to it. And I think at the moment, with the preferred positions that have been outlined, we see a fairly, you know, there is a disconnect between what the science is telling us and how we're acting, given the particular circumstances of Australia. going back to my earlier point that we are very well endowed with natural gas. So a policy position that works to sterilise the potential for gas to help the world move to that place that we want it to move to is counter to what the science is telling us, and it's counter to what the objectives that we're setting ourselves.
Thanks, Linda. Can I just quickly add to that? Just a couple of points. I absolutely concur. The Australian minerals industry, the debate on the science is done. What will happen now is it will just inform us as to how robust and what flexibility and what changes we've got to make. I don't know anybody who seriously contests the concept of global warming. What is still out in terms of the science is the magnitude of the buffering capacity of the Earth's ecological system, and whether or not the sort of stuff that Martin put up there, how far that's going to go. But the Kyoto Protocol discussion got mired. If you had a problem with the Kyoto Protocol, everybody pigeonholed you as a carbon lobby and somebody who was opposed to the science of climate change. That's just garbage. The problem with the Kyoto Protocol, it was all about targets, not solutions. We're now starting to talk about solutions. Hallelujah, bloody Lydia.
Okay, I think we've probably got time for one more question. There was a gentleman just down the middle there.
Hi, Martin Whittaker, Thomas and Coffee. I came here today with a basic understanding of what the system's about, and I'm leaving here today with a basic understanding of what the system's about, but I expected to kind of pick up a bit more about the content today, so I'll just make that apology known. With regards to duty on our carbon tax on imports, I mean, we construct things, and I can't see it as that difficult to impose a carbon duty on imports. So that I can tell you what, if we buy our steel and it goes up another 5% from BlueScope, we'll go to China to get it, and that's just no doubt about it. And I can't believe a carbon tax on imports is that difficult to do. Thirdly, we've had lots of international conferences in the world in the last few years, yet probably the increase in oil price in the US has achieved more than all those conferences in the last 6 months. And I'm just interested, there's talk about electricity margins couldn't be passed on. We've talked about petrol prices being subsidised, and we keep on coming on to the productive side, but really to turn consumer behaviour, I drove a hired Prius the other day from Brisbane Airport, and I went to a Toyota dealer. It's about twice the cost of a Corolla, but you get double of the K, so at the moment the capital cost is too high. So I just wonder what is intended to out of this scheme to really change consumer behaviour so that things that consume a lot of carbon, like petrol, like electricity, really feel the full impact of that, and then new productive methods come in to bring that down. But what's really planned to change consumer behaviour so that things like hybrid cars come in that use less petrol, so price per litre, or solar panels the like? So just pass that question on to the panel.
I might just start on that. Look, I think there's a real... there's a real problem here in that the ultimate objective gets lost in a lot of this discussion. Mitch was right to say one of the things that's getting overlooked at times in the discussion is technology. Greg was right to say actually there's a range of issues that, you know, there are half a dozen areas we're looking for solutions. We have to get a global agreement. We just have to accept that we're not going to get a global agreement tomorrow or in 2010 of the sort that's going to make it all of these transitional problems go away. So what we're trying to work towards is the sort of right long-term agreement, right long-term system. But that long-term system has to have at its heart a price signal that's sending a message about not the cost you're paying for carbon today, but the cost you're going to pay in the future. Because it's that forward price that actually will influence the behaviour. If the price of carbon today is $5, and the forward price over the life of my asset, which might be 20, 30, 40, 50 years, is $100, I'm not going to make the investment decision about which technology to use based on the $5. I'm going to basically look at the forward price and think about what makes sense. So getting an effective forward price for carbon is going to be a key part of the objective of any trading scheme. It has to be, because that's going to be what influences the decisions. But, you know, the price system alone is not going to be sufficient. That is, the emissions trading scheme is not a silver bullet. It will need to be supported by other things. Key amongst those, support for technologies. And, you know, Mitch said, we've just got to get over this nonsense that clean coal isn't part of the global solution. I don't know how many times I hear this argument put to me that it's immoral for us to be involved in coal. There are over 50 countries in the world that have commercially exploitable coal deposits. Coal technology is cheap, it's easy, it's widely available. People are going to use it for energy security reasons, no matter what we as Australia might do. So we have a vested interest in actually finding a clean coal solution, because it's actually critical for us in terms of getting the right sort of global environmental outcome. But it's not just clean coal. We've had references to hot rocks. We've had references to solar. We've got to work on a whole suite of technologies, because the wider the suite of technologies, the better options we've got of getting the right outcomes. They have to be complemented, though, by clear efforts to improve energy efficiency. Now, Des made that point earlier. Energy efficiency measures are a huge amount of low-hanging fruit, and we've just got to go into that field. We've got to stop talking about it. We've just got to get in there. So we really need, if we want to change behaviours, we need a mix of the price signal, investments in technologies, investments in energy efficiency, and basically information and education, people about what it is they can do themselves.
Can I just say what Martin just said? Martin just said that the expectation of a higher carbon price down the track is a massive piece of motivational measure for spurring new technologies. Martin just said the price system alone is not going to drive it, so therefore there has to be a partnership between industry and government in pre-competitive technology. So it's just simply not a company, even some of my big guys, who have enough depth in their pockets to fund the kind of stuff we're doing in clean coal. And it's a whole suite of technology. It's not just sequestration. It's all the stuff you do up front. It's all the stuff you do on the backside. The minerals industry in Australia, the coal industry in Australia, is voluntarily contributing over $1 billion in partnership with the government to drive the sorts of technologies we're talking about. And it's not just going to be the ones that you do today or tomorrow. It's actually what you can do in retrofit. I said before, China's building a gigawatt of power, coal-fired power stations, every 9 days. Now that will be in the supercritical and the hypercritical and all the rest of it. And everything they do in thermal efficiency, they'll get about a 2-3% reduction for every percent increase in thermal efficiency. But if they can't put a retrofit capacity on the back of a coal-fired power station, then in the words of Tim Flannery, we're cooked. I mean, the bottom line is we have to have a technology that can pick up the things that are going to be done today that are going to have an effect in 25 years. And if we don't get that kind of measure, so pre-competitive technologies, where there's a partnership between government and industry, fundamental, then your carbon prices come in, your market measurements come in that are part of the deployment once you've done the research and development. So that's what Martin said.
Can we ask Martin what Martin said? I think he pretty much got it right. Look, the other thing that we haven't touched on, but I think we should draw attention to, is there are lots of decisions being made today. Every time one of you here decides to build a new building, or state government decides to put in a new road or a harbour, you're actually putting in place assets that are going to have lives that could be 50, 100, 150 years. One of the things that we also have to do is to focus on investing in a way that deals with the adaptation challenge, because we are going to face, even if we got a global agreement tomorrow, we are still going to face deterioration in the global climate because of the stock of atmospheric CO2. So we haven't talked about adaptation, but a key part of this has to be also about getting price signals right so that people build in adaptive capacity into their new investments.
All right. Well, on behalf of the panel, I think we've come to that time where we'll have to draw questions to close. I'm sure many of you have burning questions that you'd like to ask and haven't had the time, and I apologise for that. Nonetheless, I'd like to invite John Marley from Illumina Limited up to propose the vote of thanks to Dr. Parkinson and the panel. Thank you very much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've genuinely been entertained by two wonderful ventriloquists, Mitch and Martin. I don't think it gets any better than that. But more seriously, I think the quality of the debate and the provocative comments that have been made, it never ceases to amaze me, somebody who was born in Queensland, what a prospect of a bottle of Bundy will do to get things going. So thank you very much, Mitch. More seriously, and I'll be very quick, and this comes from the Green Paper, substantially reducing Australia's national emissions will be the most significant structural reform of the economy. I think it's very, very easy to underestimate and also to understand the scale, the complexity, and the long-reaching impact for all Australians and the companies who invest and who want to do business here. Personally, I believe this prospect ahead of us is quite exciting. We do have a real opportunity to demonstrate a commitment to reducing CO2's emissions in a sustainable way within the Australian economic context, and that's very important. A couple of points I'd make that I think has become out very clearly today. Getting the design right for the emissions trading scheme is critical. There's no doubt in my mind that there is widespread support for this as a number one priority. The implementation and the trajectory to 2020 is an equal number one priority. Doing this well will create certainty and will ensure the best economic and investment decisions are made. I just remind everybody that we are already experiencing carbon being priced in higher prices for all fossil fuels, and I suspect that the very few people here today don't believe that this is something that is structural and with us for a long time. Let me also say, and this is due credit to Martin and also to Minister Wong, the Green Paper is quite transparent on the options that are available and the government's preferred position. Consultation is happening. I've personally been involved. This is important. We have constructive debate. The government is listening, and I personally and we all applaud this process, Martin. It's very important. And finally, Australia's response to reduce our carbon emissions must be progressive by creating both opportunity but also a sustainable and positive change in behaviour. To Martin, as a vote of thanks, there's no doubt in my mind that he has one of the toughest and most complex roles in the Australian government. We all have very high expectations of you, Martin, and also very high expectations of Minister Wong. What we want is clarity from the complexity. We want the right economic outcomes. That's critically important in this wonderful nation that we have. And we want a right migration path to reduce global and our carbon pollution. So on behalf of CEDA and on behalf of everyone here, Martin, we wish you success. And we want to thank you. And as you said earlier on in your speech, we want to reach our destination in comfort and safety. I'd love to be with you. Thank you. This is not a bottle of Bundy. Martin took some time off in 2007 to go and ride a bike along with his partner around Burgundy. It actually happens to be Pinot Noir, I know.